And as we've been hearing, the 1,200-page National Commission of Auditors hit like the proverbial ton of bricks ahead of the May 13 federal budget. The 86 recommendations call for deep cuts to government programs from the cradle to the grave. The sell-off of government assets like Australia Post and the Snowy Hydro, and even a major shake-up of federal-state relations. The report says if all the savings were adopted, the government would save $70 billion a year and return the budget to a strong surplus by 2023. Saul Eslake is the chief economist with the Bank of America Merrill Lynch. He's speaking with our business editor, Cheryl Bagwell.
Saul Eslake, good morning.
Good morning, Cheryl.
Well, let's just start with the premise that the Commission of Audit is built upon, that the Abbott government has inherited a budget mess from Labor that only radical surgery will fix. Now, Labor says this is all fiction, that there's no budget emergency. Who is telling the truth?
Well, the truth, as often, is somewhere between those, Cheryl, I think. There's no doubt that the budgetary position is worse than the previous government has said it would have been. There's no doubt that it's worse than it should be, given that Australia is now 22 years out from its last recession and has just come through the biggest upswing in our terms of trade in 150 years. But I don't think they've convincingly established that Australia faces a budget emergency of the sort that, for example, the British Conservatives faced when they came to office in 2010. After all, on the Commission's business as usual scenario, net debt as a proportion of GDP by 2023-24 will be about 17% compared with the present figure of 14.5%. Now, most other Western governments would be delighted if they were able to say that by 2024 their net debt to GDP would be of the order of 17%. At the moment, the average debt to GDP ratio for advanced economies is 73.5%, according to the IMF. Now, I'm not suggesting we should hold that out as some kind of aspirational benchmark or anywhere near to it. But if you take Canada as a relevant example, which I think you can, not only because there's no country that's more similar to ours economically and politically than Canada, but they're also a AAA-rated country and a commodity exporter, their net to GDP ratio is going to stabilise over the next few years at just under 40%, and no one says that they're facing a budget emergency.
Yet the Commission of Audit clearly is proposing radical surgery on the spending side. But isn't it a bit like fighting a fire with a garden hose, I guess? It's only looking at what the government's spending, not what the government's raising in tax revenues. Do you see that as being a major problem that needs to be addressed?
Well, I would say yes, although I'd also recognise that to a significant extent, the balance you draw between spending and revenue measures as a way of reducing a budget deficit is a political choice, at least as much as it is an economic choice, although political choices can sometimes have economic consequences. The Commission seems to have settled somewhat arbitrarily on a ceiling of 24% of GDP as high as revenue or tax revenue ought to go. Yet, interestingly, that figure is almost a full percentage point below the average that tax collections represented as a share of GDP under the Howard government, and there's no evidence that tax collections of about 25% of GDP had any adverse impact on economic activity during the period that John Howard and Peter Costello were running the nation's budget.
So do we need to raise more tax revenue, you know, via a deficit levy or higher income taxes on higher income earners?
Well, that's something that is more a political choice than an economic necessity, in my view. I'm not an advocate of increasing any rates of income tax. I think they would have adverse effects on labour force participation and investment and probably perverse impacts on the incentive to avoid tax. But I certainly believe that you could raise revenue, and predominantly from the better off members of our community, by broadening the base of income tax in much the same way as the Howard government sought to broaden the indirect tax base when it introduced the GST. And there's a whole raft of what economists and public servants call tax expenditures. That is, concessions, incentives, deductions, and the like on the tax side that cost money in the same way that explicit spending does. The Treasury estimates that these run to over $100 billion per annum now. There is some contest around how accurate those estimates are and the conceptual basis on which they are founded. But it is surprising in many ways that the Audit Commission didn't look at those. Bob Office's Audit Commission in 1996 certainly had a few things to say about tax expenditures, and I certainly believe that looking at those would both provide effective means of reducing the budget deficit, but also of ensuring, as the government appears to want to do, that high-income earners contribute something to the task of budget repair rather than having the burden fall disproportionately on people at the bottom end of the income distribution.
Well, let's just quickly look at some of the spending cuts recommended by the Commission of Audit. Joe Hockey described some of them as common sense, others as courageous, which seems to be code for not in my electoral lifetime. But just which one or two would you nominate as common sense and which one or two as courageous?
Well, I think most of the recommendations with regard to the pension are common sense, particularly raising the pension age, changing the indexation formula, and making it much more difficult for people with substantial means, including through superannuation income, to get a seniors healthcare card, for example. I think they're all very sensible proposals. I'm less enamoured of some of the Commission's ideas of taking the distribution of expenditure responsibilities back to that envisaged by Barton, Deakin and Reid more than a century ago, and I think the suggestions they make for returning taxing powers to the states not only won't find any favour with the states, but would probably widen the gaps in after-tax income between people who live in the richest states, Western Australia and New South Wales, and the poorest states, Tasmania and South Australia.
Would you include the recommendation that the family home needs to be included in the assets test for the age pension as courageous? I mean, one economist told me there'd be a revolution if the family home was included. Can you, you know, you support that though? Do you see a time when that would happen?
Conceptually, I think it's right, but at the practical level, recognising that $1 million house in, say, Menangatang is a very different proposition and says a very different thing about people's capacity to support themselves than $1 million house in Sydney or Melbourne. I think in reality, if you were to do this, you'd have a myriad of different thresholds above which the property would be included in the pension assets test. And I think, notwithstanding the political difficulties, the practical difficulties of implementing something like that probably means that won't see the light of day.
Are there areas where you think the Commission of Audit could have even gone further? For example, the paid parental leave scheme is still in there, albeit carved back a touch.
Yes, they seem to have treated that with kid gloves. They appear to accept that the principle has some merit, but simply want to impose an even tighter ceiling on it than the Prime Minister has now agreed it should be. I get the impression from the Commission's report, however, that they're no more persuaded that paid parental leave will boost participation or productivity than I am, and they, I think, quite sensibly recommend that savings procured by scaling back the reach of the paid parental leave scheme ought to be redirected to improving the affordability of childcare. And certainly in my view, and that of most of the experts on the subject that I've read, it's the cost of childcare that is the main barrier to increasing the participation of women with children in the workforce, not the availability of paid parental leave.
Well, we'll leave it there. Thanks very much, Saul Eslake.
Thanks for having me, Cheryl.
Lively conversation there between Cheryl Bagwell, our finance correspondent, business editor, and Saul Eslake, chief economist with the Bank of America, Merrill Lynch.